This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show with me, T. Xiao Eek. On the health show today, we're talking about training counsellors. And this is timely because the Ministry of Women, Family and Community Development has just called for more training of para counsellors or lay counsellors to provide counselling services to more members of society. Doing just that is American psychiatrist and neurologist Dr. Leland Jones, who is in town to train counsellors here in Malaysia. We check in with him on what it takes to develop such a community support system. Good afternoon, Dr. Leland. How are you today?
Very good. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And you've just arrived in Malaysia not too long ago, and you've already conducted a training or a conference, you said, which involved quite a large number of counsellors. So perhaps you could give us just a brief description of what that has entailed and what has been the reception.
Well, first of all, the reception was very good. It was very enjoyable to have so many people that are counselors or school counselors, pair counselors that are looking to understand more about psychiatric problems, especially. It was very well received, and I think I gave them some ideas on some things to consider and some techniques to use that I think will help them and help all of us.
What are the unique aspects of the training that you're doing? And you mentioned techniques. Is there anything that you felt were especially useful for us here in Malaysia in particular?
Well, you know, one of the things with mental health, one of the main problems is stigma and the shame of mental illness. And so this is like a topic that is not talked about. This is something that is put under the cover, and it's something that the patients don't talk about, families don't talk about. And so many people suffer, and many people suffer in suicide because it's not allowed to be part of the usual conversation. So breaking stigma, how do you get past stigma so people will come forward and talk about it is one of the main areas that we talked about.
Okay. Could you help me make the distinction between the role of a counselor, and there are so many terms that go around, so I just wanted to be clear on that. There's the counselor, a therapist, a social worker, a psychologist, and psychiatrist. So what are the distinctions between their roles?
Well, the psychiatrist, I'm starting with psychiatrists. I'm a psychiatrist. A psychiatrist is a medical doctor who goes back and trains more into mental health disorders. So the psychiatrist is mainly the one that is seen for the most difficult cases. And in most countries, and this I've heard also, is the psychiatrist is going to put patients on medication and use hospitalizations. So they're going to treat the more severe cases of depression and bipolar and schizophrenia. The psychologist is a PhD trained, and they do more in testing, and they do more in psychological methods of therapy and psychotherapy for a whole host of even a larger range of patient problems. Therapists. Some psychologists are therapists, and so therapists typically are trained a little bit more in how to do therapy. So they're looking at changing behaviors and personalities. Where counselors, and there are many different types of counselors, but are using suggestion and may suggest a change of diet, a change of position. So they may not be getting into deep or unconscious issues where a psychologist and therapist might. So, you know, when you're using counseling, you're just giving advice. And so para-counselors are people that are not necessarily trained, but people that have minimal training but at the same time they may be effective. So they're like at the ground level, the grassroots level. So they're going to be on the street like befrienders and people like that. They're going to be somebody that you can contact very quickly.
Who can train as a lay counselor then? Or who can qualify?
I'm not sure specifically, no, but I would say that anybody could train to be a lay counselor. Like befrienders and some of the other groups like that, they can accept anybody. You necessarily don't have to be degreed or have to have any necessarily background in counseling.
So in terms of counselors then, what would be the qualifications that are generally accepted?
To be a counselor? The counselors, depending on whether you're a school counselor, whether you are a mental health counselor, that's going to be different depending on what kind of counseling you're doing. I'm sure if you're going to be a school counselor, you may not have to have a master's degree. There are degrees in counseling. There are degrees in substance abuse counseling, for instance. And in that area, many of the counselors have a associate's degree or a one-year or two-year college degree. And so there's a whole host of counselors at that level that have some college, they're college degreed, and but most of them are going to be, I would say, are going to be less than a PhD.
Okay. And of course, you mentioned that psychiatrists deal with the complex cases, and because of the nature of the specialization that is required to become a psychiatrist, they are so few in number. In Malaysia, we have a ratio of one psychiatrist to 200,000 population, whereas the ideal, as recommended by the World Health Organization, is 1 to 10,000 population. And clearly, we are far behind in Malaysia. So how do you think lay or para counselors can fill the gap until we can reach that recommended ratio?
Well, I can tell you what, in the United States, we are not where we need to be either. And so what has happened there is that we use nurse practitioners and we use physician's assistants. So these nurse practitioner is a nurse who has training as a nurse and usually as a psychiatric nurse. And they go back to school for 2 years or 2.5 years, and it used to be that most schools, it basically would be like a master's degree. So they would recommend that you have a bachelor's in nursing or in science, and then you go back for 2 more years. But now they're really pushing it so the nurse practitioner has a doctorate degree, and so as the physician's assistant. So a physician's assistant actually doesn't have to be a nurse or can have somebody who has a bachelor's degree and get a 2-year physician's assistant degree. The difference between a nurse and a nurse practitioner is that the nurse practitioner can prescribe medication.
Right.
Both of them can prescribe medication. So it's almost like a nurse midwife. So a nurse midwife is a nurse that has gone on with training, and so they deliver the babies. So they're out on the field, and so with normal pregnancies, they deliver babies. And so same thing with these two. They can see most patients with mental illness that need medication, and so for the most part, they can be a psychiatrist. And also if they need more specialized or inpatient treatment, then they would send them to an MD or a DO.
Okay. Then what scenarios do you foresee that lay counselors could play a role where psychiatrists may not be in sufficient amounts or even fully trained counselors?
Well, because there are so many people that are depressed and so many people that have mental illness and even mild mental illness, we tend to focus on the severe mental illness like schizophrenia or severe bipolar, but most people that have, quote, mental illness have the more milder forms. Now, the more milder forms can certainly exasperate and into, nervous breakdowns and psychosis. But for the most part, most people are grieving. They have mild depression. They have mild anxiety disorders. And so they don't need to see a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist is so overwhelmed that, you know, they are just going to take a few minutes and prescribe medication. So for the most part, for instance, grieving. We're just talking about that in this conference earlier today, that here's somebody that's grieving. They lost a family member. They maybe lost two or three. Or maybe they were in a crisis and people were murdered. And so there's grief counseling. And so they may not need a lot of training, but many places they're trained just in doing grief counseling. Mm-hmm. And that can be very effective. And it doesn't take a long – it doesn't take many sessions. But they do it for families. They do it for individuals. And because they are doing it for so many people, they can really help people get through a very difficult time in their lives.
And I would think that these kinds of counseling services can play a bigger role in community setting, mm-hmm. perhaps even outside of the medical setting. And are there environments that require more in-house mental health services than others, such as prisons or even workplaces or low-cost housing?
Yes, there are all of these situations, and on in a crisis where there is in a catastrophic illnesses from tsunamis and earthquakes and crisis intervention. So there are counselors that are trained in crisis situations. They can be first responders, and they're the one taking somebody to the emergency room, but there are people that have seen things and exposed to things that if they're not treated quickly, they will wind up in more severe cases. So yes, in schools and prisons and in homes, there are counselors that go in homes, and so you name it, you're going to find counselors there.
Do you have a sense of the kinds of services that are available in Malaysia? Would you know enough to comment?
No, I don't know enough about that and what you have and what's adequate and what's not. So I can't really speak on that.
Okay, fair enough. We're going to go for a quick break now. I've been speaking to American psychiatrist and neurologist Dr. Leland Jones, who is in Malaysia to train counselors together with the Ministry of Women, Family and Community Development. We'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back to the show with me, T. Xiao Yik. We have in the studio with us American psychiatrist and neurologist Dr. Leland Jones, who's speaking about the importance of training more counselors. Now, we've covered before the break the role of the different the different scope that will be played by, for example, a psychiatrist, a psychologist, and the important role of counselors when dealing with from mild to moderate and severe mental health issues. But when it comes to especially those who have recently undergone crisis, as you have mentioned as well, who is severely traumatized, is it possible that a recommendation for counseling might not be well received, and especially for perhaps for family members who are trying to encourage them to seek counseling? And what is your advice on broaching the subject here?
Well, if you're talking to a family member on how to get another family member help, that is a very difficult situation many times because. And I mentioned earlier about stigma and stigma of mental illness and stigma of just it's a subject that in American psychiatry, many of the conferences in the last several years are based on stigma. What are we going to do? Because the majority of people refuse care. Families don't talk about this. And so the suicide rate can be very high, and people don't even know why people are suiciding. They are totally clueless as to why these things are happening. And I think a big part of that is because these mental illnesses are not talked about in schools. They're not talked about in colleges. And so it's seen as shameful. And, you know, then one of the things I mentioned at the conferences this week, and I showed some slides, and, the pictures really help, is I showed famous people, celebrities and famous people that had bipolar or are treated for bipolar depression or whatever. Now people are coming out of the closet, and they're saying, yeah, I have, you know, I've struggled with alcohol and cocaine or whatever, and, you know, I'm bipolar. And I showed them pictures of some of their favorite movie stars, and they're like, my goodness, look at these. So they're talking about it, so it makes it easier. It's like the Me Too movement. So people are coming out and admitting these things, and so it makes the average person, it's easier for them to admit things, talk about things, and want to get help. And so I think that's been huge internationally, so that people can talk about it. So I think that's one of the main reasons it's not talked about is because of shame. You know, you don't even want to get help. So you almost would rather die than get help.
And that relates to, of course, the stigma of having the condition itself. But I'm sure there are also misconceptions about mental health care, mm-hmm. where perhaps many people still relate it to hospitalization mm-hmm. or the padded cell. What are the kinds of misconceptions that you encounter?
Well, I think the main thing is just embarrassment, that that if you have symptoms, I think there's so little education on what's normal that let's take major depression, which is the number one, and many studies show that the number one disability in the world is major depression. So it's not cancer, it's not AIDS, it's major depression. So minor depression would be like grieving and adjustment disorders and, you know, trying to adjust to work or stressors. It's major depression, and it's just mild, moderate, and severe. But so the person is not functioning. They're not thinking clearly. They don't have their energy. Their self-esteem is poor. And see, so in a way, they're different than they were. And so it's hard for them to express themselves. And you don't say, you know, family members, I'm struggling with major depression. The family, many times, if they're not taught, they're like, Johnny, what's wrong with you? Why aren't you going to school? Why aren't you going to work? Why aren't you taking a shower anymore? Why aren't you eating? What's wrong with you? Maybe you need to go to the doctor. And that person may be too embarrassed or too allergic to really even talk about it. And then it can run in families. And, you know, you're just like your uncle and you're just like your grandfather. And look what happened to them. You're a bum. And, you know, and so one of the problems with, quote, mental illness is it looks like physical illness. Maybe you are vitamin deficient. Maybe you have low thyroid. There are a whole host of medical conditions that look like depression. And so one of the things the doctor is going to – so it's actually for most patients, the first person they should see is their family doctor. So they can do medical tests and see what's going on because, there are so many medical conditions that look the same. And so then most of the antidepressant medication, for instance, is prescribed by the primary doctor. They're not even sent to the psychiatrist until the medical doctor has tried several things. Start feeling uncomfortable about and refer them to a psychiatrist. So as psychiatrists, we don't tend to see people necessarily off the street. We tend to have people referred to us by counselors or physicians because they realize, okay, this person's a little bit out of my league. And so actually most of the antidepressants are prescribed by the primary doctors, and for the most part, they do well. Mm-hmm. So they do well with mild and moderate depression. Mild and moderate depression can be treated with a whole host of things: exercise, a better diet, getting some sunshine, having better friends, a whole host of things. Yoga, meditation, all of these things work for mild and moderate depression. Mm-hmm. The thing is, you have to prescribe it, and they have to do it. Mm-hmm. So once you get into the moderate and severe depression, That's where the psychiatrists are more likely to be seen.
Is there a risk that somebody may miss this critical window for getting professional help?
Yes, all that is a question. That's a critical window. So, are you are you thinking about this, that if you pass this window, the person may suicide? Or is that what you're thinking?
That's right. Is there a line at which, you know, beyond that, perhaps you're right. Perhaps it would escalate into suicide, or the kind of therapy required would be much more intensive?
Well, yeah, I don't think there's a line. I think there is a gradation from mild, moderate to severe. And then some people, for instance, have seasonal affective disorder. They get depressed every season, every time of the year. And people have PMS, and so every menstrual period they get depressed. Or some people actually, during their menstrual period, get so depressed they get psychotic. They get violent, or they get homicidal or suicidal during those few days. And that's like a mood disorder. It's like a bipolar. So I don't think there's any – if you're alive, there's still time. As far as being suicidal, there's not like a specific time or window because you really can't tell. You know, there aren't very good tests to say, okay – You know, as a psychiatrist, you see a lot of suicidal patients in the emergency room, and which ones there you're going to admit and which ones there. And so really a big part of it is in your gut. If you're in your gut, you know, you feel like this guy really is – I don't feel comfortable with sending them home. We can commit them against their will. Legally, well, you have to stay in the hospital. Well, I'll take you to court. Take me to court, and the judge is going to say, you're dangerous. You're homicidal. You're suicidal, you know, and the psychiatrist says you got to stay. Well, I'm not going to let you out till he says you're ready to go, because there's so many suicides. And so most of the people are not getting help. The vast majority of people with depression are not seeing a counselor, therapist, psychiatrist, or anybody. Mm-hmm. So they don't see anybody. So and many times they don't know they're depressed, or the family that's, you know, it's, you know, he's always been like that. You know, what are we going to do? So, like, for instance, how do you get somebody like that into therapy? How do you get them into counseling? That can be a real challenge for any family. Mm-hmm. How are we going to help them if they don't want to go? So, I don't want to go. I'm too depressed to go. I don't want to see that person. You didn't ask that question, so.
Yes, no, absolutely. And, I mean, sometimes it's a dual problem. It's the individual himself or herself not wanting to go for therapy. It could also be the family members not recognizing that this is something that requires therapy.
Or the family members just thinking that he's just like everybody else in the family.
Yes, that's right.
And your
father's like that.
Yeah, so the company policy, the family policy is we don't go out. We say in America, what happened in Vegas stays in Vegas. You know, what's happened in the closet, we don't talk about it. You're not going to shame the family into talking about these things.
Why do some people, and you've talked about facing crisis and grief, why do some people deal with traumatic situations better than others?
Well, you brought this article up about grandmothers. I think one reason is because the traumatic experiences can accumulate. If you've had, we talked about ACEs, A-C-E-s, and at the American psychiatry is now moving more into dealing with ACEs, adverse childhood events. And so now we recognize that the more of these adverse childhood events that a person has, they were neglected, they were abandoned, they were orphaned, they were mistreated, they were violated, there's incest or whatever. And the more of these things you have, the more physical illnesses, the more mental illnesses, the more substance abuse, the more drug abuse you're going to have in the adult. So I'm delighted in that, because now we're talking about etiology, which is the original cause. And so in American medicine especially, it's a lot of pharmacology, so we would treat it with medication. What is the medication for this condition, that condition, as opposed to saying, what is the cause of this? So going back to your question, if you have a lot of ACEs, in fact, if you go online and look up ACEs, A-C-E, ACEs too high, you'll see that so a person that has so many traumatic things already in childhood, they need just one more thing and they got a nervous breakdown. As opposed to people that have more resilience, they're going to have more ability to handle things because they have not been through things. So that's one of the things, is the number of ACEs. So then we add ACEs to stresses. So one is from childhood and one is what's going on now. So if we have a number, if we're stressed out, then in what's going on now, then you can't handle much more. So for that reason, you're not going to be a good counselor for somebody because you can't handle what you have now.
And you mentioned the article on grandmothers, so I just wanted to summarize that a little bit. It's an initiative that's being carried out in Zimbabwe, where because there are so few psychiatrists there to deal with mental health issues and depression being a major problem, they've actually recruited and trained grandmothers in evidence-based talk therapy. And so they have a friendship bench, and grandmothers sit on this bench, and people within the community who have issues can come and unload their troubles on them. I mean, how do you envision an initiative like this taking place? Is it very similar to a formal counseling session?
Not necessarily. I think grandmothers are in a unique position because they're respected, and so there's less. There's less resistance. There's less of what we call a negative transference. And so, you know, if you had a male physician and you were molested, abused by a male, then you're going to have problems with that. And so grandmothers are seen in the community there, and I think in worldwide, as people of compassion and people of wisdom. And so, you know, your grandmother is somebody you can talk to. And it's not like they're going to be shocked, like, oh, my God, I never heard of such a thing. You know, grandmas are going to say, well, honey, I got to, you know, I got a lot of grandkids, and, you know, they have some of the same problems you have. And then I see also in this article there are 80,000 suicides per year.
In Zimbabwe.
Oh, my God. It's like we need all the help we can get. And so you don't have enough psychiatrists. And so you may not need so many psychiatrists if you have lay counselors and people. And then the other thing is that the grandmothers are trained and so in mental health. And so they already have a wealth of knowledge and experience. And it's like, you tell the grandmothers, okay, this is what mental illness is about and this is what depression is about. And so they can take their own expertise and add it to the training. And I'm sure that's a great idea. I think I never heard that.
Do you think it's a lot to put on lay people to have to listen to these really serious issues of the people who are coming to talk to them?
Well, in fact, you know, even in this article, grandmothers are, there's something different about grandmothers. Okay, they're on another league.
I agree.
than just the average Joe or even the average mother, because I think, you know, as a grandparent myself, you sort of look at, you know, there's a saying about grandparents that if I had known that grandkids were so wonderful, I would have had them first. So grandparents can say, you know, I these things I did were wrong. I wish I hadn't done those things in my kids. And so now grandkids come along, and you have your own childhood, and you have your kids' child. Now this is almost like a third chance. Mm. And so if you're past grandkids, now this is your fourth chance. And so by the time this person comes, it's like, you know, I really can help you. Mm. Because, you know, I've seen this before.
All of their wisdom and experience comes into play. And interestingly, the article also pointed out that they bring in a lot of indigenous cultural norms mm-hmm. into the therapy as well. And, going back to our conversation, self-care is often one of the first things we neglect when our mental health is affected. How should we ensure that we can take care of ourselves, whether it's with a minor or a major condition?
Well, that was one of the main things we talked about yesterday, and then that was another conference I was doing, and that was another area, because burnout is such a common problem, and compassion fatigue is a major problem, because people that get into this field, these fields, tend to be compassionate. They're caring. And so compassion fatigue happens when you are overwhelmed with so much traumatic issues. And so the compassion fatigue can lead to burnout, which can lead to depression and then disability. And so I had just a number of slides in which, for instance, we showed how people that are somewhat perfectionistic have problems because they want everything to go right. And so I'm going back to the grandmothers. I'm sure they have more flexibility. They don't feel rigid in the way they present themselves. So, yeah, the ability to take care of yourself and unload your burdens and to be able to talk to someone. Because, you know, the suicide rate is very high in psychiatrists.
Yes,
and physicians.
That's right.
Physicians have and counselors, because and going back to the stigma, you can't talk about these things. Who are we going to talk to about this? And so as counselors, we really need to have people that we can talk to and that we can trust, because that's another area.
How do we build that, you know, next layer of counselors and therapists for the people working in mental health?
How can we? How should we? Are we? I don't think we are. I think that's something that's really needed, and I don't think that's on the drawing boards right now.
Mm. Well, it should be.
It should be, yes.
And actually, this is something I should have brought up earlier, but what does a counseling session look like? What takes place? And, you know, just to remove perhaps... hopefully, the sheen of stigma that comes with counseling, relate it to, you know, when you're in trouble, you seek counseling. But what can you actually talk about with a counselor?
And even as a psychiatrist, I see people that you see professionals. I see people that want to make more money. Mm-hmm. You know, the way I handle my problems right now, I'm not. It's almost like a counselor is a coach. I'm not making money because I have this attitude. I want my grades to be better. So they may not have a specific mental illness, but they can see they have a mental block.
Right.
There's something hindering them from being successful. So they're very excited about bringing their issues up. So they're motivated. So usually, especially in psychiatry, now you can have other areas, but you're bringing a chief complaint. I think as a physician, you're like, what is your complaint? Now, I can offer you a lot more than what your complaint is, and sometimes that's frustrating because I want to give you so much more, but you're just really, you know, accepting something minor. But usually a person comes in with a complaint. Okay, this is my complaint. I can't sleep. I can't think. I can't function. My boss sent me here because of certain issues, and so that tends to be the chief complaint. Now, that may have many tentacles as far as other areas in your marriage or in your children or your finances. So so you just basically explore that. I think one of the differences between a counselor and a therapist, the counselor is going to tend to give more advice. Well, the therapist is going to look deeper and say, okay, why is this happening? What is going on in your family? What is going on in how you see situations? And so, you know, I'm not saying one is wrong or one is right, but the therapist is going to go deeper and spend more time. And so, and a lot of people know they need therapy. They've gone to a counselor. Counselor gave them advice. Maybe a lay counselor. Maybe at their mosque. And maybe they're chaplains. You know, they're chaplains on the job. Mm-hmm. They're chaplains. They hire chaplains and coaches. And so you've gone to the coach. They've given you some advice. You've taken that. But I realize I have something a little deeper.
So the counselors are the first, the gates.
Yes.
You know, and then if you need to go deeper, like you said, mm-hmm. you'd go on to the next mm-hmm. level.
Right.
You did mention that some people are more resilient than others. Is it possible to pull through a crisis or you know, mental health issues troubling you without having to seek external therapy or counseling?
Sure.
Or does that just perpetuate the idea that the myth that you have to be strong all the time?
Well, you bring up several points there. But being strong all the time, many times strength may be part of tenderness and compassion and empathy. So those kind of qualities may not be seen as strength all the time. And so as a counselor, many times you have to get on their level. You have to validate them. You have to appreciate where they are. And so that may, for some people, be seen as a sign of weakness. So you have to go down in the well where they are before they're going to ask you to let you bring them out. You have to say, okay, they have to get to the point where, oh, my God, you understand. You really are with me. You feel what I feel. What do you think I should do? There's a ladder there. Let's get out. Now, if you try to get them to take the ladder at first, they're like, you don't understand me. Mm-hmm. You're not here with me. So I'm not going to listen to you. See, so that may be seen as weakness because you're going down the ladder, you're going down in the hole with them. So, yeah, I think resilience is more fluid, and so yeah, you want to be at the place where and see this should be taught in schools. We should be teaching our kids how to be more resilient. How to deal with grief? How to deal with loss? You know, we talk about fire drills and bomb drills, which I think we need that. But how do you deal with? In one of the seminars the other day, we talked about some of these kids have seen hundreds of murders. Okay, so we should try to turn off. In fact, this is really something. The gadget. Problems. You've mm-hmm. heard about the gadget problems where these kids, 9 and 10 years old, are having sex with other kids they learn about online.
Mm, on a virtual platform.
Yeah. So they're picking up, then they're really literally having sex with people. Yes. So what is the school's responsibility? What are parents' responsibility? Because, I was at this conference. That's the first time I heard that one. So these things need to be taught in schools and just basic self-care and basic resilience and basic this is not good for you.
Well, you've met a lot of the counselors here in Malaysia and from the different levels and the different types of services that they provide. What would be your advice for the profession here in Malaysia in terms and you've heard from them about where they want to go next and what they hope to achieve. So what would be your advice for them in order to reach more people with mental health problems?
Are you referring to people that are already counselors, or are you referring to people that are interested in going into counseling?
Well, firstly, those who are already counselors. Mm-hmm. But would you have any anything to share with those who are interested in counseling as well?
Well, talking to the suggestions to the Ministry of Women and Family and Community, I think one of the things that's very positive is putting on these kinds of seminars for their own counselors and para counselors. And some of the feedback that I got from people was coming from a psychiatric, and my seminar was on trends. These are the new trend. These are the newer trends that we're going into. And so, like, for instance, I mentioned the ACEs. That's huge. I'm so glad that we're talking about etiology. We're talking about the cause. And another trend that we see is the trend of the biopsychosocial spiritual model. So instead of just treating the symptoms or treating the syndromes or treating the problems, now we're treating the whole person, and we're treating the whole person by recognizing that mental illness, for the most part, is related to trauma. Mm. Okay, there's some kind of trauma or neglect in childhood, and so if we don't deal with that, then you're going to have a nation or a globe of wounded people. And that's why, there's so much depression. They said like 40% of Malaysians have a mental illness.
Yes, at least 1 in 3.
Isn't that
yes.
something?
Yes, it is.
And so it's like, what are we doing? It's like the highways are filled up with people. And how are we helping them? Are there television shows? In fact, this is another thing is online groups and online therapy that are very effective, and some are just as effective as seeing an individual. And in some places, there are groups, for instance, with everybody that has a panic disorder or phobias or depression, or and so they're very specific. And actually, patients go on there, and they interact. And so you have people that some of these groups are manned by professionals and some are by lay people. But for instance, people with agoraphobia who don't go out of the house, afraid to be in crowds, that's great. They can get therapy at home. Mm-hmm. And so that's an area that really needs to open up sort of outside of the traditional counseling couch that you can get, you know, you can get it from your school, from your teacher, your counselor online, because it's too big for, you know, for the existing system.
Hmm. So a lot more people have a role to play in providing that kind of support.
Yes.
Well, that's all the time that we have for this. So thank you very much again, Dr. Leland, for joining us today. I've been speaking to American psychiatrist and neurologist Dr. Leland Jones, who was in Malaysia to speak to the counselors here. And you've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.